Call is now being recorded.
Hi, all. Welcome again to the Groundwork Forum podcast. This is your host, John Heerdink. Glad to be able to bring today and introduce you to a good friend of mine that I've known for quite some time and who is a brilliant physician and has a great deal of experience that I think we all can learn from. His name's Eric Kazarian. He's out of Southern California, and he's a guy that I think is going to shed some light on medical devices today for us and the process around it and his experience directly. Again, Eric he's a professor in the USC Caruso Department of, I don't even know how to say the otolaryngology. I'm sorry, Eric. I'm not a doctor here, guys. Head and neck surgery. He can also, like he says, he can also say ear, nose, and throat surgery for us laymen who are not physicians at the Keck School of Medicine of USC in Los Angeles. That is an intro, Eric. He's also, guys, he is one of the relatively few surgeons focused on surgery for obstructive sleep apnea and snoring. As he said, because of his unique focus, he works with many established and startup medical device companies as they develop new products and perform clinical trials before and after they use these approved by the government bodies like the FDA or Food and Drug Administration. So, again, Eric, thanks again for joining us today. Would you add anything to that sort of botched up intro I just gave you to a brilliant physician?
Well, you're too kind. So it's a pleasure to join you. And for the record, I guess our specialty, the formal name, is otolaryngology and neck surgery. And I guess if you can pronounce it, you pretty much can be a specialist in the field.
Well, thanks for understanding, which, as you know, I am not a specialist, but you are, thank God, and it's great to have you on the call today. So, you know, Eric, what else would you like to say anything in regards specifically to your field before we go into the, speaking about medical devices today? Anything to add that's current that you'd like to throw at us?
Sure. So obstructive sleep apnea and snoring, too, but are important common problems, and obstructive sleep apnea in particular can be associated with not just snoring, but also disruption of your sleep. And what that can lead to is being tired during the day, having low energy level, fatigue, challenges with your memory, things like that. But it also can create some health implications, whether high blood pressure or somewhat increased risk of strokes or heart attacks. And the health risks are more when we're talking about severe obstructive sleep apnea, but the disruption of your sleep and all the consequences can occur whether you have what's called mild, moderate, or severe sleep apnea. And there is a range of treatments starting with relatively straightforward, what we think of as behavior changes, including avoiding alcohol or other things that might sedate you within 3 hours of bedtime. Sometimes you only have snoring or sleep apnea when you sleep on your back, so staying off your back during the night can be really helpful. And then weight gain is a major risk factor for these, so if people can lose weight, that can often be very helpful. Of course, for sleep apnea, there's something that is becoming more, well-known to people with it. It's something called CPAP, or continuous positive airway pressure. It basically involves a machine that functions a lot like an air blower and basically blows air in through some sort of mask, either through your nose or your nose and mouth, to effectively balloon open your throat a little bit. So it is a treatment for sleep apnea because it balloons open your throat and prevents that blockage in breathing that can occur during sleep, which is what sleep apnea is. Then there's surgery, which there's a wide range of treatment options, and there are also special kinds of mouthpieces called oral appliances that can be very helpful for both snoring and sleep apnea. And the thing is that we always obviously start with the conservative treatments, but when people can't sleep comfortably with those machines, the CPAP machines, so with both snoring and obstructive sleep apnea, that's when we think about possible surgery. And that's where I come in. So it's a common problem that's challenging, because surgery, unfortunately, doesn't work quite as well. None of the treatments work as well as we'd like, including surgery. But the key, really, when it comes to surgery, is that there are different options out there they work differently, different people, and there's probably some reason why they work differently, different people. So one of the main areas of focus of my career is not just snoring and sleep apnea surgery, but it's actually how we choose different procedures for different patients.
Interesting. So what is, by the way, when you say it's a fairly common affliction, what do you have any stats to share with us as far as how widely or percentage-wise that this affects
sure. people in
I mean,
the US I think that, well, so as we, you know, as a nation, as, you know, the world gains weight, because weight gain is such a big risk factor for snoring and sleep apnea, these things are becoming more and more common. But going back about 10 years ago, the National Institutes of Health estimated that it was about 20 million American adults. So it's a pretty common problem, and again, those numbers are probably just increasing over time. I think depending on how you define it, obstructive sleep apnea can affect, I guess, the most conservative estimates are 2% of women and 4% of men, but I think more, I guess, current estimates are quite a bit higher and just unfortunately continuing to grow. And it's also very common, by the way, among children. I don't myself treat children, but sleep apnea and the, you know, similar problems are very common. In fact, that's the number one reason that children have their tonsils or adenoids removed is because of obstructive sleep apnea.
Interesting. I didn't realize that was an issue for children. I don't, today, is it common practice today to take out tonsils? I know it was when I was a kid and I had mine out, but it wasn't because of sleep apnea. But today, is that a common practice?
Sure. No, back in the day, it was most commonly because of repeated sore throats, like strep throat or other reasons, what we would think of as chronic tonsillitis. And there's always, we talk about the pendulum in medicine swinging back and forth. And so at one point in time, every child was getting their tonsils removed. And then sort of right around the time that we were kids, it stopped being quite as common and then became even less common. And then now it's becoming a little bit more common. And there are reasons, of course, to get your tonsils removed or not to get them removed. And sleep apnea is actually becoming even more of an issue leading to tonsillectomy than repeated sore throats or chronic tonsillitis is, because the antibiotics that we have to treat sore throats and strep throat are becoming better, are doing a better job.
Interesting. As far as children, is it also because of weight gain in many cases, or what is the cause of sleep apnea in children?
Sure. Well, I think it's a combination of factors in children. In children, obviously, everything's a little bit smaller. So if they get enlarged tonsils or adenoids, it's going to create more issues with breathing at night. And honestly, we're a little bit more, I guess, aggressive or less tolerant, I should say, of snoring or people that are having a little trouble, kids that are having a little trouble breathing at nighttime, because there is some decent evidence showing that increased symptoms very much like ADD or ADHD. And so I think that because everything's smaller, big tonsils and big adenoids can block breathing more easily. But children, unfortunately, they're facing the same sort of weight gain issues and obesity issues. And so whereas tonsillectomy or adenoidectomy used to do really well in taking care of obstructive sleep apnea in children, we're seeing a lot more children that aren't getting the response that we have been accustomed to getting because of other issues that are playing a role, like obesity.
Interesting. It's fascinating, a field that I'm sure many of us don't know a great deal about, and it's great to hear from you, and I look forward to exploring that more. But I guess we should probably dovetail back towards this medical device, medical device development issues around that we sort of teased people at the beginning of the conversation. So if you wouldn't mind, could you simply define in some way what a medical device is, or what it can capture across, I guess, the field? How would you define it, I guess?
Sure. Medical devices is a pretty broad category according to the FDA definitions. I mean, it ranges from the most simple things that you don't really think of as being devices, things like basic tongue depressors, but to very complicated things like nerve stimulation devices that are put in the human body. And in fact, a big question that relatively recently has been sorted out relates to software, because more and more, I guess, machines as well as, you know, smartphone apps can include software, of course, that have some bearing on health and can be used to improve health. And the FDA has some oversight even related to things like software, such as software that aren't what you would initially think of as medical devices. So it's a fairly broad, you know, the official definition is fairly broad and includes a wide range of varying degrees of complexity, basically.
Interesting. So what is your experience? Have you worked with companies or trying to launch medical devices? What's your direct experience in the space?
Sure. So I used to live in the Bay Area, and, of course, when you live in the Bay Area, sometimes you catch the bug, the innovation bug, and I had the good fortune of working with companies based there but also elsewhere who had devices or were thinking about new ideas to treat snoring and obstructive sleep apnea. And so I worked in various capacities as consultants on scientific advisory boards, and even actually have a few patents of my own, and have thought about forming companies and or getting people to take over ideas and form companies. And it's fascinating, of course, to develop your own ideas or be involved in setting up clinical trials. And that's involved some consideration of how things work with approval processes in this country and honestly around the world, how these approval processes work for different types of medical devices. Pharmaceutical industry is a totally separate, field within the healthcare innovation sector. And just because obstructive sleep apnea at this point in time, the application or the use of medications to treat obstructive sleep apnea is much more theoretical. It isn't really used in practice very often. So I don't have much experience on that side, but it's been with medical device companies and including some of my own ideas and some, you know, thoughts about taking the initiative myself.
Gotcha. Thanks, Eric. So as far as developing medical devices, do you feel like the process here with the FDA is one that, is easily worked with today? Does it need to be improvements? Do you think, you know, what obstacles are, I guess, in front of us? Or can you sort of sum up what you, or give direct examples of what you think are issues or are actually, you know, great about the process?
Sure. Well, there are three processes or pathways, I should say, by which the FDA approaches approval or clearance of medical devices. The first one applies to low-risk devices like a tongue depressor, where it's pretty straightforward. They've been around for a while. They're considered low-risk, and those are pretty easy to get a new tongue depressor, for example, approved by the FDA. Now, there are medium or moderate-risk devices. There's a process called the 510K process that provides for FDA clearance of devices. And that basically implies that you have a new device that is very similar to existing devices. The risks are only moderate in nature. And if you basically can show some, you know, fairly straightforward data and both on safety as well as that it might actually provide some benefit, it's a, I guess, reasonably straightforward process to do that. And then there are separate pathway that requires FDA approval, which is a more higher level of scrutiny for higher risk devices, like the implantable devices that, for example, do nerve stimulation. They're inside the body, and it's much more involved. And in fact, these pathways have been, you know, they're in constant flux in a way. I mean, they're not changed in a dramatic way from year to year. But as recently as 2011, the Institute of Medicine, which is a pretty well-recognized organization within, you know, medicine itself, had really criticized the 510K process because it was a little bit, I guess, too random, and it wasn't really working to protect safety, and it wasn't working well to get useful products to market. And so they had a big report issued in 2011 that has really spurred the FDA to provide some changes to that. Of course, you know, the FDA is responsible for protecting the health of individuals in this country, and so they're not going to they're set up somewhat to be risk averse by design. And I think that they're working on and really outlined a process where people do studies before you get to approval process, but they're more often requiring studies to be done even after approval, based on especially on some difficult experiences that occurred with medications like Vioxx or other things where there were a lot of risks that weren't fully explored in the pre-approval studies that came out more after drugs were approved, and the same thing has been applied to the medical device world.
I got it. That makes sense. So, with that said, is this something that, in this, with the changes that have occurred and that might occur, what do you see happening in the future when it comes to development of medical devices? Do you see this as an improved environment? Do you think that this is an immediate change, or how do you see things sort of developing going forward?
Sure. Well, I think no one has a crystal ball, and there are people that dedicate their entire career to this. So I'm sure there are as many opinions as you'll find people out there. I think that I've been on various presentations to investor groups where, for example, we've been side by side with some startups in the tech world, and you basically see that there's a similarity in terms of enthusiasm, dedication to your product, et cetera. But it seems that the medical device world is much more set up for, I guess, somewhat incremental benefits rather than sort of revolutionary changes, because the FDA now is more, I guess, the whole processes to bring something to market are smoother for devices that are not exactly disruptive. And it's funny because not only do I work with medical device companies, but I'm also involved. Sometimes people reach out to me, potential investment groups, to evaluate potential new technologies. And the word that's often, or the phrase that's often thrown around, is game changer. And it's medical device world, when I think about it, I've seen a lot of things that have been billed as game changers, and oftentimes, unfortunately, they haven't really worked out. But it seems like, in talking with some of my friends who are more experienced as investors, that game changers, it's almost, almost discourages investors and discourages people, because it will require almost reinventing the wheel. It will require creation of new sort of processes by which the FDA would evaluate something before giving clearance. For example, if you have what you think of as a fairly straightforward device that would fall into what the FDA considers a moderate risk device, but it's too different from what already exists, well, that's going to be a much longer process to get the FDA able to sort of get it through the usual steps in the FDA clearance, whereas if it's something that can easily fall into another category but is simply a better device that does something that existing devices already do but just does it better or cheaper, et cetera, that's actually going to have a much smoother way to get through the FDA and come to market earlier with less in the way of an expensive clinical trial. There have been many devices, and unfortunately, with my field, nothing works perfectly. Certainly nothing works perfectly for all comers when it comes to obstructive sleep apnea. There have been a lot of products where tens of millions of dollars have been invested and used in trials that have not made it to market. And so when you start out with something that's already going to be complicated to get through the FDA, and you're facing what's going to be an expensive trial, it's really been a little bit of a challenge for investors to, or at least experienced medical device investors, to wrap their head around it and really be willing to commit to it.
I see. I would. So it sounds to me that there's probably room for improvement in the FDA process. So, because if we're discouraging investors to take a chance on game-changing sort of medical devices, that seems to be counterproductive to, at least that's my reaction. And but at the same time, I understand it from the investment group. We, this is the game that's sort of laid out in front of them, and If you're not in the habit of losing your money or swinging for the fence, necessarily you want to grow that capital, and maybe it's not. And so if the FDA has this attitude, maybe it makes sense to shy away from those TOPS opportunities, which is not healthy for development, I would suggest. Do you see that sort of, the FDA game regarding medical devices changing substantially, or is this just sort of what we should expect over the next few years?
Well, I think it's in the FDA, the people of the FDA, by the way, I happen to have come to know a number of them, and certainly dedicated and committed to doing the best thing, and their priority, of course, is protecting safety. I think that there is good reason for making it not so straightforward. I think that what's probably going to be happening with the FDA is making it more common sense based and having, I guess, silly reasons, for lack of a better way of putting it, silly reasons for making FDA approval complicated, hopefully going by the wayside. There have been some changes to eliminate at least some of the randomness of the way the FDA has worked for many years. In one of the more recent important developments in sleep apnea has been actually an implantable nerve stimulator device. Basically, the tongue can fall back during sleep and block breathing and be a major part of obstructive sleep apnea. And one of the newer therapies that exists and does have FDA approval is a device that can stimulate the nerve that moves the tongue. It's called the hypoglossal nerve. And the technology is based very much on heart pacemaker technology, so it's something that's straightforward from that standpoint. But there was the device that's approved had an expensive trial, and it showed that it worked really well, and it is available now, in the U.S. It turns out that I happen to work with a different device company that submitted their proposal to get a trial approved by the FDA at around the same time and was sent to a different part of the FDA, even though the devices were very similar. And it turned out that it had a different study design that was going to be required for approval by the FDA than the first device I mentioned. And it turns out that even the devices probably worked very similarly, the differences in the way the study was required has led to the first company being approved by the FDA, the second company basically filing for bankruptcy after the trial wasn't working out well. And it really is part of the randomness, and I think that examples like that are leading to making things more streamlined and straightforward.
No, that makes sense, and hopefully we're on a course for that, for all of our sakes, right? Would you add anything else? Is there anything particularly you're working on in the field that you'd further like to highlight today, or you pretty much covered the subject?
Well, I think you covered the subject. I think that there are always things that people are working on, and I think one of the exciting things may be use of medications to treat selected patients, and we're following the same pathway that every field of medicine is, making things cheaper, simpler for patients, and hopefully more effective. And that's really the way forward. I think that's what everybody wants.
I would tend to agree with you, Eric. Well, thanks again for sharing with us your insight and understanding. It's truly valuable. And thanks again for joining the Groundwork Forum community, and we look forward to hearing from you in the future on other topics. And if you have, as developments occur, please feel free to jump back on with us and get us updated. Thanks again.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thanks for letting me join you all.